Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's time for an open mailbag episode of the Council of Trent podcast, and appropriately enough, a pro-life open mailbag episode. It's pro-life month, pro-life week. Here in a few days, I'm going to be flying off to Washington, D.C. for the March for Life. In particular, I will be at the Pro-Life Summit. So Students for Life America, Live Action, a bunch of other pro-life groups are getting together for a Justice League level event, getting all the best pro-life speakers and activists together in one place. And for some reason, they invited me along as well. I'm going to be doing an advanced apologetics session at the It used to be the Students for Life of America Conference, but now they're partnering, so it's the Pro-Life Summit. And I'm going to be taking people a little bit deeper on the question. Stephanie Gray and I are also going to be tag teaming to do a special lunch hour with the Ivy League students. So I think like Harvard and Yale, we're going to do a special like lunchtime advanced session with them as well. And then there's going to be other workshops all throughout the day, a bunch of great speakers. If you haven't signed up yet, you're going to be out there. You should definitely consider, especially if you go to high school or college, you should check out the Pro-Life Summit. So this week, in the previous episode, we had our pro-life boot camp. I talked with Cy, and we got up to snuff about how to share the pro-life message. What I thought would be fun would be to add Q&A. So, you know, a lot of times we get Q&A at these talks, and to provide that are our patrons at TrenthornPodcast.com. If you want to be able to submit questions here for this podcast, if you want to ask me any question you have. And we do these open mailbags usually about once a month, but I might do them with more frequency. And I kind of like this tailoring them. So maybe the next one I'll do will be a Bible-based Q&A or Protestant apologetic Q&A, because then it'll keep all the questions kind of in one field. And so if you ever wanted to ask a question and get it answered here on the podcast, you can do that. If you're a gold or nth metal subscriber at TrenthornPodcast.com, nth metal being one of the most powerful metals in the DC Comics universe, you get kind of first dibs at getting your questions answered. Usually I'll post a special post on the Patreon page and invite gold and nth metal to put their questions in. After those come in, I then open up the field to everybody, and I try to get to as many questions as I can. So if you want to take part in that bonus, as well as other bonus opportunities we have, and support the podcast to make it something really awesome, consider becoming a subscriber at TrentHornPodcast.com. Also, a little homework to help me out here. Consider going to YouTube and becoming a subscriber of the Council of Trent YouTube channel, where you'll get access to our short-form videos, rebuttals, and lots of great content there. Just that's easy. Just click subscribe. You don't have to pay for anything there. And I'm working very hard. Let me know, by the way, if this changes. I'm not putting ads on my videos on YouTube. I really don't like it. I just remember the day in YouTube, you could log on and just watch what you wanted, and then the ads popped up. I am grateful, though. I'm grateful YouTube, for most of the ads, lets me skip them in 5 seconds. If they didn't let me do that, I'd lose my mind, and maybe finally the Christian version of YouTube would take off. GodTube, I think is what it's called. I don't even know if it still exists, but I wouldn't be able to handle that. But support it, because so by supporting the podcast at TrenthornPodcast.com, you allow our YouTube page to grow. I'm actually in talks right now with a local Catholic radio station. They like the podcast so much, they want to run one episode a week, a half hour block, for people there just to hear it, because they told me we're really starving for positive Catholic radio. They said a lot of people we've looked at are really negative about the faith right now, and you're really building people up and have a positive message. But it's positive, but it's not cotton candy. It's actually equipping people to do the work of evangelization. So you guys are helping that. And if you want to keep that going, subscribe to YouTube, go to Google or iTunes, Google Play or iTunes, leave a review, and consider supporting us at TrenthornPodcast.com. And when you subscribe there, you can become a member where you get access to bonus content like submitting questions we're getting today. So let's jump right into the questions for our pro-life Q&A this week. Question number one, how do you respond to someone who has understood that being born isn't enough to be a person, since non-human animals are born too, but says that you have to be born and a human organism? Is the definition of person as any member of the human species as arbitrary as the human species plus being born? It's absolutely arbitrary. So when people say, well, you're not a person until you're born, one of my replies is, yeah, but dogs and cats are born every day. Does that make them people? They all go through the birth canal, a birth canal. Does that make them persons? Well, no, you have to be human and born. Why? You should always ask why, because if birth does not make non-human animals persons, the process of birth, why would it do that to human beings? It's clearly just an arbitrary category. Now, human beings matter. The human species matters. People disagree about why it matters, but they see that that's not something arbitrary to hold on to when it comes to being a person. So that's not arbitrary, but just saying human plus born, as my friend Stephanie Gray says, you know, that's the same as human plus white or human plus male. Why don't we just get rid of the plus part and go with human? I mean, you could say to them, look, well, you can also say there's a counterexample that cuts against this. They say, oh, well, a person is any human that's born. You can't just be born. You got to be human and born. Okay, but what if an alien came to Earth, like Superman or Spock? Well, Spock is half human, but, you know, you looked at, well, I don't know, he's half human. He's not fully human. He's half human, half Vulcan. But take Superman. He's Kryptonian. He is not a human being, but he was born, I assume. I don't know a lot about Kryptonian anatomy. I don't know all that, everything in Superman's Wikipedia page or Super Wikipedia, whatever it might be. But if we met an rational alien that was a person for all intents and purposes, but wasn't human and was born, we would say they're not a person. So no, the better definition of a person is an individual being with a rational nature. Humans are persons, angels are persons. If there were aliens out there, they might be persons. So it is just to say a person is any human that is born and not just anything that's born is, of course, completely arbitrary. So, alrighty, let's move on to question number two. What do you think about using a comparison of a human through pregnancy to an investment? The zygote would be similar to a 1 cent investment, which has a 99% chance of doubling every day or some other incremental increase. And the newborn is analogous to the investment once it is maxed out. The comparison illustrates that while, of course, the finished product is valuable, it would be foolish just to throw away the investment because it is small. Now, what's interesting about this analogy, it kind of reminds me of John Noonan's argument against abortion. He said, even if the unborn's not a person, they have a really, really, really good chance of becoming a person. And a sperm or egg have no chance, but a embryo has a really, really high chance to become a person. Therefore, we should at least consider that they're persons. They're not like sperm or egg. Now, I don't like these kind of probability-based arguments. I think it's better to say, no, they are a person, not because of what they may become in the future, but because of what they are now. Now, what they are now, something important about what they are as an embryo, is the future that they have in front of them. And so that's important. But they would still be a valuable person even if they were to die a few days after being conceived. That's why I still like the Polaroid analogy. I get the investment analogy. You start with an investment and then it grows. But investments and money, we consider their value and how they grow over time. They're not valuable until they hit their max. I like the Polaroid analogy because when you take a Polaroid picture, it's valuable right then and there, even if you can't see it. And so I know Shannon Q did not accept that analogy, but I think for any other person, if you were in a position where you had an award-winning photograph, if I said, I'm going to destroy one of these two Polaroids, this Polaroid was the one you took a picture of an award-winning event. And this other one is just a blank Polaroid that was in the camera, but they both look the same. Which one should I destroy? Most people who are not debating abortion would say you should destroy the blank one because it's not valuable. It's not a picture at all. But the one that is a picture, even if it doesn't look like it yet because it hasn't had time to develop, that has value even if we cannot see it. So I get the investment analogy, things growing over time. But human beings, they grow and they develop in a different way. They have all their value at once, their intrinsic value and their instrumental value. It grows over time. So instrumental, like how valuable you are at doing things, but your intrinsic value because of what you are, that does not change because human beings have intrinsic dignity because we're made in the image and likeness of God. All right, next one. I was recently asked what would happen to all the unwanted children if abortion was banned. Who would raise them and be financially responsible for them? The answer is if abortion were outlawed, and we look at this, when you look at cases, there was a study conducted by pro-choice people called the Turnaround Study, and it asked what happened to women who wanted to get late-term abortions and couldn't. Well, what happened is the vast majority of these women chose to raise their children. The same thing happens to people who don't choose abortion. Most of them raise their own children. Adoption is still a very rare option for people to choose. That's why I think adoption is great to promote, but ultimately, it's not the widespread option. Parents have a natural maternal and paternal instinct that is strong and for good reason, which encourages them not to choose adoption. And it can be detrimental that even parents who are abusive to their children can't get over that instinct and will choose to raise them instead of placing them in a non-abusive home. So you would say that people would care for them. And at this point, some people will bring up what happened in Romania. They'll say that in Romania, when the communists took over in Romania, at first abortion was legal, but the birth rates got too low. So Nicolae Ceaușescu, the ruler of Romania during the communist period, he outlawed abortion and to increase birth rates. Now, people will say he outlawed abortion and then a bunch of children ended up in Romanian orphanages. And it's horrifying. I mean, if you want to lose sleep tonight, look up children of Romanian orphanages. They were kept in abusive conditions. They're malnourished. They're neglected. They were almost feral children. It's super duper sad. And what people will say is that happened because of abortion. No, what happened was Ceaușescu put in these policies that said you had to have children, that you couldn't even use something like natural family planning, that you were fined or taxed if you had no children, and that it was a requirement for people to have a certain number of children. And of course, it's a communist state where everything is just awful anyways, and you're going to have these terrible conditions. And conditions have improved since the fall of the Soviet Union, but you still see a lot of these children or people end up in orphanages that don't actually, they have parents, they just get dropped off there. But it's a different complex net of reasons to explain why that happened there. Whereas you go to other places like Ireland, like Poland, where abortion, now Ireland recently, their abortion laws changed, but for the long time while their laws were very restrictive, they did not have these horrifying conditions because they didn't have these oppressive communist regimes. So if abortion were outlawed, most people would just care for their children, or they might, if they were to place them with someone else, usually they get placed with relatives or things like that. But at the end of the day, we cannot say it's all right to kill a human being just because we're concerned about the subpar living experience they may have. We should address their subpar or detrimental living experience, not kill them to avoid it. That's not finding a solution. That's just quote unquote eliminating the problem by eliminating the person we need to help. Let's see here. How do you address the morality of abortion with someone who has already had an abortion? How do you tactfully and lovingly address it while keeping in mind the highly personal impact abortion has had for the person? First, I think you should empathize with them. If they are someone who is genuinely hurting and they share this with you, you should empathize with them and listen and do more listening than talking. And to empathize, say that must have been very hard. That must have been very difficult. You must have felt this way. I could understand how someone would feel that way. I feel sadness about what you went through. I feel sorrow for you. You know, it's like when we say, like, I'm sorry that happened. We're not apologizing. We're saying, I am experiencing sorrow at empathizing with what you have done, what has happened to you, the circumstances around it. So to empathize and then point that person towards hope and healing in Jesus Christ and in the gospel, that ultimately that is what, whenever we do something to royally mess up in life, and when it's big, could be abortion, could be adultery, could be abandoning one's family. It could be other forms of killing, someone who drank and had a DUI and killed someone. All of us have done things to varying degrees that we are ashamed of, but we can't just pretend it's not there. It still eats us up inside. We have to turn to Jesus Christ to have that shame be replaced with his grace and then to continue healing. And you should point that person to say, you know what? This might be a long conversation to have. And to always point to, I am pro-life because I believe every single person is valuable, whether they are in the womb or out of the womb. Even if they are out of the womb and they have had an abortion or even take part in abortions or perform them, they are valuable because they're made in the image of God and God loves them. And I think that's important to share with them and then to point them towards healing ministries like Rachel's Vineyard, because even if someone finds grace and healing through the sacrament of reconciliation or whatever means a person may find through God, even if they're not Catholic, there's still trauma there they have to work through, probably for the rest of their lives. So I'd recommend Rachel's Vineyard as a good option for people who are post-abortive. Definitely check that out. Let's see here. What would a post-Roe versus Wade world look like if the Supreme Court overturned it? Well, what would happen would be there would be statewide battles. I think some states would outlaw abortion. And then there'd be many states where it's pretty entrenched, California, New York, lots of other states. It'd be a minority of states where it's outlawed, or at least it's much more severely restricted. And you might have just more laws in general that restrict it maybe at the first trimester or the second trimester of pregnancy to draw that kind of dividing line. And then it would just kind of be a statewide battle in that way. Though I think that by the time, I'm kind of cynical of the court a little bit. I feel like sometimes the court follows public opinion. Like the court changes its mind on same-sex marriage when it seems like the majority of people change their mind on same-sex marriage. So I feel like I'm hopeful by the time the Supreme Court would overturn Roe versus Wade, a larger majority of people would see that abortion is wrong and we'd see a cultural shift. And so it'd just be a different landscape entirely. Other people ask, and there were other questions in the Patreon about this, what would the punishment be for people who have abortions? When people ask this question, it's often like kind of a gotcha moment for pro-lifers. I am not a fan of the answer. Now, if you're in a bind, you're on radio or you're somewhere else, I will say that's a legal question and it requires a legal answer. Not all killings are prosecuted equally, but we can all agree that the killing of the unborn should be illegal, and it'd be up to courts to decide what is the best, you know, to decide the circumstance. Because a woman who kills her husband for his life insurance and the woman who kills her husband because she fears for her life because he's abusive, they're going to be punished differently because circumstances matter in punishment. So that's one option I have when this comes up. The other thing you should say is, look, you can ask the question, should parents be held responsible? Should they be punished if they kill their own children? You say, yeah. They say, does it matter how old the child is? Then you kind of put the burden back upon the other person. Now, honestly, like what kinds of punishments would we see? Well, I think that most laws that if somebody, and you have to say, remember, if these laws are passed, we live in a society where the vast majority of people consider abortion to be the killing of a human being, to be murder. So when people think you would punish people having abortions, well, yeah, it sounds absurd now in a culture that's fairly pro-choice, even if they just say they're pro-choice to get along. But if the culture was different, it would make sense to people. What I would say, though, what would make sense is look at the laws we have now for when women kill their own infants. When women kill their own infants, they usually don't go to prison for life or even a long time. A woman who does that is not considered a threat to other people in general. She's just a threat to herself and her own offspring. So someone who did that, who killed her own infant, sometimes they only get a few years under the UK specifically has infanticide laws to cover this. They might be incarcerated for a few years, whereas someone who murdered an adult and is a threat to society at large may be incarcerated for a much longer time. So if there are laws already that treat infanticide as a different crime than homicide in general, we could have laws that treat feticide, especially for the mothers involved, different than the killing of adults in general. Because remember, I'm just asking, treat the unborn like a newborn. And so if we have laws that make infanticide a separate special kind of crime, different circumstances, we can do the same for feticide. Though I think that doctors who are making money and do this all the time, I say lock them up. They are a threat to the public order. I say lock them up and, they're throw away the key, basically. If that's what they're doing, and it's the same as any other doctor who's euthanizing people over the age of 65. If you bring in your grandparents to them, they've fundamentally contradicted the Hippocratic Oath in that regard. Speaking of Hippocratic Oath, here's our next question. Hi, Trent. I'm a medical student involved in pro-life groups and efforts on my campus. My colleagues who defend abortion take a relativistic stance that if abortion is what the patient wants, they have a fiduciary duty to provide the medication or perform the procedure or refer to it. And they knew getting into medicine, they would do things that they don't necessarily agree with. What I would say here is that people who say this, like, oh, well, I'm a doctor, I have to provide this for my patient. I have to provide this for them, even if I don't want to do that. That's not how the medical industry works. You can't say, oh, I'm going to do whatever the patient wants. The doctor is supposed to act in the patient's best interests. Now, oftentimes the patient knows what's in their best interest, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes the patient wants something that is not in their best interest, and the physician has to decline that in order to be a good doctor. So you can bring that up. There's an article here in the American Medical Association in the Journal of Ethics. It's Autonomy, Conscience, and Professional Obligation. And this is what it says. I'll read it. It's lengthy, but it's helpful to answer this question, that patients have autonomy. They have negative autonomy, which means they can refuse treatment. And the courts have upheld that patients almost always have the right to refuse treatment, especially when it's not for a life-threatening illness. That's your autonomy. It's your body. You can refuse treatment if you don't want it. That's negative autonomy. But the article says, on the other hand, the case for positive autonomy, that a patient's demand obligates a physician to provide a treatment, is not nearly as compelling. The paradigm here is the professional's right to refuse to provide a requested abortion if doing so would violate the professional's conscience. This right of the physician to refuse is well established in U.S. federal law, U.S. state laws, and international law, has been upheld by professional statements. This is used to give you some example. Physicians are allowed, quote unquote, to refuse on the basis of a legal standard, like the request for a non-approved drug, a professional standard, a request for non-beneficial treatment, such as hyperbaric oxygen for a completed stroke, a clinical judgment. Like, let's say I want an antibiotic because I'm really sick. And they say, well, you don't need an antibiotic and it might make you worse, so I'm not going to give you that. They can make a clinical judgment or a personal choice. They'll say, in a non-emergency situation, I'm not able to do this procedure. A doctor could just say, I don't feel confident doing this particular procedure on you. Doctors have lots of different reasons to refuse if it is for the patient's well-being. And I think that should provide for abortion, for a doctor to say, look, I treat unborn children. I'm a gynecologist. I promote unborn children's welfare. I cannot kill the same children that I am trying to heal. It would be a fundamental contradiction of my duties. And so I would say to this questioner, say, look at positive autonomy, that doctors already refuse patients for a variety of reasons when it's not in their best interest. And they should be able to say that, you know, yeah, some entire procedures that are quote unquote legal, I don't think they're in a patient's interest. And so I don't do these procedures whatsoever. It'd be different. It would be wrong if you had a doctor say, well, I'll do abortions on black patients, but not white patients, because I want to get rid of black children. Yeah, that would be racist and discriminatory and wrong. But if he just says, I don't do abortions in general, then there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. Next question. If a friend chooses abortion, am I allowed to sit in the waiting area? Can I drive her to the appointment, even though she's my friend and I want to be with her on her faith journey? No, you can't do that. You can counsel someone. And even if in that circumstance, what you can't do is you can't assist them in it, even if you have good intentions. So you couldn't drive your friend to the abortion facility. In doing that, you would be cooperating with evil. You wouldn't be formally cooperating because you don't intend the evil, but you're providing the material means to make it possible. And so that would be cooperating with evil. It would be a sin to do that, to say, well, I'll drive you to the abortion center because I feel bad for you. I don't want to be there for you. You can't do that. Now, maybe if they're walking to the abortion facility, you could walk alongside them and trying to plead with them, please don't do this, please don't do this. There, you're accompanying them, but you're not making it possible for them to do this. And second, if you drove them there and sat in the clinic, and let's say someone sees you walk in with your friend to an abortion facility, they don't know you're trying to talk the friend out of this, or that you're trying to provide emotional support. They may think you, as a good Catholic, are accompanying them. And so maybe it's not wrong. That would be the sin of scandal. And it would make other people think maybe abortion's not so bad. So I would say no, that you can't physically accompany someone or provide them transportation to receive an abortion, but you could counsel them and be alongside them as possible without helping them. Rather, you're just there to try to talk them out of it. Like if you saw them get off the bus and they're walking then, and you walk along with them as far as you can to talk them out of it, and then explain to people nearby, I'm trying to talk my friend out of this, please pray for her. But to walk with them and go inside and sit in the waiting room, I'd say no, it's cooperation with evil and it could cause scandal. Let's see here. From what I understand, Trent, the Catholic Church does not have a teaching on when ensoulment occurs in a human person's development. Does ensoulment affect when we consider that a person becomes a person? You're right. The Church does not have a specific teaching on when the soul enters the body, though it's the common view among theologians that it's when the body begins to exist, which would be at conception. The soul is the principle of life. It's what animates the body. We would naturally assume that the soul begins to exist when the body that it animates, when an animated body exists, and that would occur after a successful conception, after the sperm conjoins with the egg. Now, exactly when that happens, it's a process. It takes 24 hours We don't know exactly when that is, and the church hasn't spoken to it. In the 1974 Declaration on Procured Abortion, this is what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith said. This declaration on abortion expressly leaves aside the question of the moment when the spiritual soul is infused. There is not a unanimous tradition on this point, and authors are as yet in disagreement. For some, it dates from the first instant. For others, it could not at least precede inundation. Oh, man, I copied this from here, and maybe it got cut off or was formatted weird. The point is, it is not within the competence of science to decide between these views. Science doesn't tell us when immaterial souls enter physical bodies or whether they're present. Because it's not a question in its field, it's a philosophical problem from which our moral affirmation remains, i.e. the opposition to abortion remains for two reasons. Supposing a belated animation, that the soul enters the body later in pregnancy, it is a philosophical problem from which our moral affirmation against abortion remains for two reasons. Supposing a belated animation, so the soul enters the body later in pregnancy, there is still nothing less than a human life. Preparing for and calling for a soul in which the nature received from parents is completed. So you have a fully human life with a human nature. It just doesn't have an immortal soul. It's still a human life we should value. On the other hand, it suffices that this presence of the soul be probable, and one can never prove the contrary, in order that the taking of life involve accepting the risk of killing a man, not only waiting for, but already in possession of his soul. So the church says, we don't know exactly when the soul enters the body, but because we don't know that, we shouldn't take the risk and not kill what could very probably be a human being with an immortal soul, with a rational soul. It's a full human being. Or even if it's a human body waiting for a soul, which is not the church's official teaching, and I would say most theologians would put it, the soul enters the body at conception. But even if the soul came later, you still have a human life here waiting for that unique soul. And so that human life would cease to exist if you killed it. And that would be a grave wrong. That would be wrong. And you go back to St. Basil the Great in the early church, and he said, we decry the sin of abortion, whether the fetus is formed or unformed. So I would say, to answer this question, when people talk about abortion, I say, look, I'm talking about a legal question about protecting human beings. People always accuse me of being the religious whack job trying to impose morality or religious tenets. No, my arguments in public for abortion, all my arguments for abortion do not rely on the question of a soul. They rely on scientific arguments for the humanity of the unborn and basic philosophical arguments from equality and justice. So the principle of the soul comes up in religious pro-choice people. But the point is, I would say to them, you prove the unborn do not have a soul. If you have the burden of proof, you say it's okay to kill them, you prove they don't have a soul and it can't be done. And the Declaration on Procured Abortion says that even though the church does not take an official position on this, that does not preclude the church from taking a position on the wrongness of abortion, even if it does not take a position on when the soul enters the body, because we shouldn't kill if we don't know. And regardless, even if we didn't know, it's a human life and we should respect human life. All right, we got a few more questions here. This is from a gentleman named Nick, who actually, I think I gave a shout out to him in one of my previous episodes. He was commenting on the Patreon. Thanks for your input. He asked a few questions. How do you define organism? I would say an organism is an individual living being that can develop into a mature member of a species. So not that it definitely will, but that it has that capacity and it is a collection of organs ordered towards that end. It's not a body part. It would be an organism is just an individual living being. There's lots of kinds of organisms. There are single-celled organisms. There are also multicellular organisms. There are the different kingdoms, fungi, animal, plant, eukaryotic, bacteria, prokaryotic. Like I would say on the border of what an organism is, like a virus, I don't think a virus is an organism. People disagree about that a virus is more like a molecular machine that hijacks other living organisms in order to reproduce. There's dispute about that, but I would say viruses probably aren't organisms under this. But under what any definition of organism you give, the unborn are going to pass it with flying colors. How do you respond to a definition of personhood that classifies humanity and sentience as necessary conditions? So what's important to remember here is that a necessary versus a sufficient condition. Necessary means in order to be it, you must have it. And sufficient condition means if you have it, you are it. So let me give some examples. a necessary condition for being president of the United States is being 35 years old. I'm 35 now, actually, so I could be president. That's not a job I would want, but you have to be at least 35 years old to be president. It's a necessary condition for the job, but it's not a sufficient condition because so you can't be it without it, i.e. you can't be president without being 35 years old. But it's not a sufficient condition. Sufficient means if you have it, you are it. So being 35 is not a sufficient condition for being president of the United States because there are many 35-year-olds who are not president of the United States of America. But a sufficient condition for being president of the United States of America would be if you are the commander-in-chief, if you have won the majority votes in the Electoral College, if you earned 270 votes in the Electoral College. That is a sufficient condition for being president, because if you've done that, you are it. So when I rebutted the idea that being human and sentient is what makes you a person, what I did with Shannon Q is I pointed out that can't be a sufficient condition, that if you have it, you are it, because there are many things. Sentience is not a sufficient condition because there are sentient non-human animals that are not persons. They have sentience, but they aren't persons. So some people may say, well, I'm not saying it's a sufficient condition. I'm just saying that being sentient is a necessary condition for being a person, or being human and sentient is necessary. It may not be sufficient. You might need other things, but if you don't have humanity and sentience, you are not a person. And so what I would say here is I would provide a counterexample. And I would ask first, why is this necessary? Why do you have to be sentient to be a person? And why isn't it a sufficient condition then for other beings that do have this trait? Why? And I would give a counterexample. What about a comatose newborn? What if you had a newborn who had not developed the property of sentience yet, but would shortly after birth? If they haven't, you would justify infanticide. Because if a newborn who is in a coma, a reversible coma, has not been sentient, they lack that necessary condition, don't they? But most people would say that it's murder to kill a newborn in a reversible coma. I use reversible here because some people on the other side may say, well, if it's irreversible or we don't know, it would be euthanasia and it's fine. Well, let's say it's a reversible coma this newborn is in. This newborn has never been sentient. They're still a person, even though they lack this particular condition. In fact, in my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, in the end notes, which you got to check out the end notes of my books. That's where I hide all my little gems and Easter eggs and little geek out sessions are in the end notes. I point out that Bonnie Steinbach makes this argument in her book, Life Before Birth. And that's her pro-choice argument. It's from Oxford University Press back in 92. And her response to this comatose infant counterexample, she says, although strictly speaking, this comatose newborn infant does not have interests of her own, we treat her as if she did because she is so close to having them. And that's bad. What do you mean she's so close to having them? What if her coma was going to last another 9 months? If that's the case, there are other unborn children that are close to having interests. So I talk about that in my book, and Chris Kazor in his book, The Ethics of Abortion, deals with this too. By the way, if you want to go really deep in this subject, get Christopher Kazor, K-A-C-Z-O-R, The Ethics of Abortion. I highly recommend it. As the owner of Men's Warehouse says, to borrow a riff from him, you're going to like the book that you read. I guarantee it. Finally, when I offer the breastfeeding analogy, people respond with the objection, it's not analogous to the risk of a mother's health in pregnancy. The risk in pregnancy is greater than what we ask other people to do, such as women to breastfeed their children when there's no other option. But now notice when people say this, that they would say, oh, you can't be forced to use your body to help someone else. What about breastfeeding? Well, yeah, you can force women to breastfeed their children if the alternative is starvation, but you can't force people to do something risky like pregnancy. Well, now you're setting up something arbitrary just to delineate between our natural duties as human beings, that our natural duty parents have to children is to sustain their lives. All of us were sustained in this way through pregnancy. It should not be considered an extraordinary thing. We all went, even if you've never had children, you were a child and you went through this process. So it should not be treated as an extraordinary thing like organ donation or tissue donation or things like that. Plus, we do expect people to make sacrifices. For example, it may be considered politically wrong, but it's not considered morally wrong to draft men as soldiers in war. Men are conscripted to risk their lives for the good of other citizens. So that's very risky. In some cases, combat is going to be riskier than in undergoing a pregnancy. Yet men can be conscripted to use their bodies in this way. Men can be conscripted to say a man has to work and pay child support for 18 years, even though that might put him at greater risk of heart disease, greater risk of a heart attack or diabetes or whatever the case may be. So we put restrictions on men's bodies and require them to do things. And it can naturally make sense in pregnancy, which is different, of course, because it's a natural outcome of humanity. It's something that we as human beings, we not just have a right to life, we have rights and responsibilities towards one another. Finally, here's one that was asked and upvoted. Which policies help lower the abortion rate? Now, when this question comes up, I point out that that's not the main issue per se. We're not trying to just reduce abortions. We want to restore the legal protection unborn children once had. We want to restore that legal protection, not just reduce abortion. We want to right a wrong that exists in our law and exists in society today. Now, lowering abortion rates, I'm in favor of doing that as long as we don't do anything that is immoral. So I am agnostic on the question of whether contraceptives lower the abortion rate. It is possible that they do. I have not completed a full investigation of the matter. But even if they did, that would not justify supporting them because it's an intrinsic evil. It's something that's wrong. It would be on par with saying pornography is an outlet for men, and so we should promote it to keep them from raping people. Even if that were true, I don't believe there's evidence for that, but even if it were true, I've heard evidence for it, but once again, I haven't fully answered the question because even if it were true, I'm not going to promote the evil of pornography to achieve a certain kind of good. We cannot do evil that good may come. But then there's other issues. People say, well, if you eliminate poverty, won't that reduce the abortion rate? Well, poverty is related to the abortion rate in the sense that most women who choose abortion are impoverished. But that doesn't mean they're more likely to. There's just more poor people than rich people. I wrote about this, I think like a year ago, but here's what I wrote. It's true that the majority of women who choose abortions have incomes near the poverty line, and they cite economic reasons. But it does not seem true that greater income will make a woman less likely to choose abortion. A 2015 study from the Brookings Institute found that pregnant single women who make about $12,000 a year abort 8.6% of the time. So if you live at the poverty line, you abort about 9% of your pregnancies. Whereas single women who make $47,000 a year abort 32% of pregnancies. Women in extreme poverty are four times less likely to have an abortion than women with four times that income. It gets even higher when you get up into the higher things. And if you look at abortion rates, if you compare, for example, the highest abortion rates are in relatively affluent states like Maryland, New York, New Jersey, and the District of Columbia. But the lowest abortion rates are in actually somewhat impoverished states like Wyoming, South Dakota, and Mississippi. But those states where the abortion rate is low, it's because they have hardly any abortion facilities. If you want to reduce the abortion rate, people are always looking at this, we got to reduce demand. And we can do that. And pregnancy resource centers help do that. And we absolutely should. But I think the most effective way to reduce the abortion rate is not to cut off demand, it's to cut off supply. When you have states that have only one or two abortion facilities, you have really low abortion rates because people just don't go and avail themselves of abortion when it's not available, and they don't go and run to back alleys either to do that. Like if you look at Wyoming and Vermont have similar populations and similar household incomes, but Vermont has six abortion facilities in a small geographic area, and Wyoming only has one. Wyoming had 120 abortions in 2014, but there were 1,400 in Vermont. This confirms research by Michael New in the 2011 issue of State Politics and Policy, where he showed, quote, abortion restrictions like waiting periods and informed consent laws are correlated with reductions in the incidence of abortion. So I hope that's helpful for you guys. Thanks so much for submitting to the Pro-Life Open Mailbag. I'd love to do other open mailbags. If you want to get in on this action, consider becoming a supporter at TrenthornPodcast.com. Access to bonus content, to pro-life mailbags, free access to my Trent tracks, my digital audio series when they come out. Lots of great stuff to share with you. I hope you all have a blessed week, and please pray for me as I give my talk at the Pro-Life Summit this weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content, For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.